This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Hello, everybody. So I'm Lee Fennell. Some of you may already know me. I am here today to talk about risk reversals, which a little animation there. So the basic idea behind this idea, behind this project I've been working on is starting with the notion, of course, it's very familiar to you, that law and social arrangements allocate risk in all kinds of ways. So the law may decide to shift risk between people. It may decide to leave risks to fall, leave losses to fall where they do. And we can think about, though, moving from those default positions in a variety of different ways. Okay, so very familiar to everybody is the idea of insurance. So if you have a loss that the law leaves with you, leaves you exposed to some risk, you can pull that risk through insurance and move to a different risk position. You can sort of reverse that allocation in a sense. But it's also possible to move in the other direction, to do something like reverse insurance. If you start off in a position where law effectively insures you against some risk or causes some other party to insure you, then you can move from that position as well. So academics have talked about this idea in a bunch of different ways, but let me try to give a concrete example. This is the idea of selling unmatured tort claims, and it's been discussed in the literature for a number of years by a variety of people. The unmatured part here means that you haven't gotten hurt yet. So the idea is that if the law gives our protagonist here, Ace, the right to recover from people who injure him or from companies who make products that injure him or whatnot under some circumstances, then we have something that works from Ace's perspective like a form of insurance. Maybe Ace would rather take his chances. And so he might seek out a reverse insurer, in this story, Beta, who, and this is before getting hurt at all, and say, look, give me a lump sum that represents the expected value of my claims over my lifetime against people who might hurt me. And Beta makes that payment. Ace assigns to Beta the right to then collect on Ace's behalf if somebody later hurts Ace, right? So the idea here is that instead of being in a situation where Ace enjoys this social insurance, Ace effectively undoes the transaction by getting back an expected value that's equivalent to those claims. Okay, so there's a lot of wrinkles and problems and refinements and ways of talking about this, but that's just to give you an idea of how you might move from a position of being insured to a position of not being insured. It's part of a larger body of work. I threw a few citations up here and be glad to elaborate further for anybody who is interested afterwards. But really, this area got going in the 1960s with Kenneth Arrow looking at this notion of complete markets in risk and what if we could sort of effortlessly go from being insured to being uninsured, could effortlessly insure against all kinds of risks. Then it wouldn't really matter sort of what allocations we started off with in the law. You'd be able to move around to whatever other position. This is sort of an application of the Coase theorem if we didn't have transaction costs and if markets were complete. Of course they aren't, but people have thought about ways that they might be more complete. So we have people like Calabresi talking about reverse insurance, anti-insurance. Cooter and Perot recently wrote about the idea of windfall reversals. If you're expecting that you might get a windfall, would you rather have the lump sum now that represents the expected value? Unmatured tort claims we just talked about. It's also possible to make markets more complete by just insuring more risks. So there's lots of different things that now are not insurable, but that could be. And Robert Shiller has written a lot on this topic. So let me go through a few examples of different kinds of reversals. One idea would be selling rights to social insurance. So what if you were able to sort of get a payment that represented your potential claims against the welfare system, against Social Security, and so on, and then agreed to forego making those claims in the event that you qualify for them. Well, that sounds kind of crazy, but there are sort of small versions of this that exist in some welfare systems where there's sort of deferment payments that you can get in a lump sum if you agree to forego seeking the sort of monthly benefits for a period of time. So it's a bit like that, and we could imagine stronger, weaker versions. You might sell rights to possible prize winnings. Maybe if prediction markets give you a good chance of winning the Nobel Prize, but you would rather have the expected value, you might be able to make a deal and assign your right to the actual winnings should they materialize to somebody else. Another idea a lot of people have talked about is that you might sell shares of your future home appreciation to other people and thereby have money that you could invest in something more diversified than your home, or insure against home price drops that have to do with things out in the market. Shiller's also talked about livelihood insurance. Maybe you're going into a profession, you don't know if it's going to pay off. You could perhaps buy a form of insurance that would give you payments based on indexes that show some kind of drop in the profitability of your particular line of work. Life settlements and viaticals also are kind of another type of reversal that's out there in the world. Here, people that have life insurance policies but decide they'd rather get the money, sort of money for them now, and assign to somebody else to collect when they die. Another possible reversal mechanism. Also, selling shares in future earnings. There's often interest in this. People might want to not take a risk on some particular type of profession and might want other people to take equity shares in them. Randy Newsom, who's a minor league baseball player, tried this, tried setting up a website to sell future shares in himself. And I guess, unfortunately for him, he got some unwanted attention from the SEC, and it turns out it's not quite as easy as that to sell shares in yourself, but, you know, we could make it easier. Okay, so in all these cases, what we're talking about really is taking some kind of a gamble that's out there and having an exchange of an expected value for that gamble. It can go in a bunch of different directions. You might be paying out money to get a positive value gamble, like when you buy a lottery ticket, or you might be trying to get rid of a negative value gamble, like when you buy insurance, or you might get money back in order to take on some exposure, some negative value gamble, or to give up a positive value gamble. Maybe you hold a lottery ticket and they've announced, and all like six numbers have to match, and they've announced the first five, and maybe you'd like to sell it right then and get something for it. Okay, so we can also have different ways in which we shift around risk. There, that's an example. You can have shifts between two parties. So if you have a tort system, a products liability regime, let's say, that effectively insures consumers against injuries from products and makes a manufacturer bear risk, you could imagine having a waiver that would do this, right? The consumer gets some money or maybe a cheaper product and bears the risk. You could also make these things triangular, very familiar to have insurers, right, that allow both of the parties to be insured by offloading the risk. You can also have a reverse insurer, which would create a world in which both are exposed. The reverse insurer then holding a claim against the manufacturer, and so there might be advantages in some cases to either of these configurations, and so this is just examples of how reversibility might come about. My interest here is sort of in thinking about reversibility more systematically and really looking at the fact that society has to ask a couple of questions, has to make a couple of different decisions about risk. It has to first figure out what's going to be the default allocation of risk, and then it has to figure out how sticky to make that default. And stickiness here can range from impossibly sticky, like we're just going to forbid you from shifting that risk allocation at all and put very heavy penalties on you if you try to do it, to very easy or even subsidized or even allowing people to do it as of right unilaterally and so on. And so fans of Calabresi and Melamed may recognize a parallel here to their discussion of entitlements that society and land use conflicts and the like has to figure out who's going to hold the entitlement and how to protect it. This is a bit of an analogous kind of set of decisions. Okay, so one reason for caring about reversibility And one reason that I think it's important to think about it when we think about risk is that it can achieve a few different ends for us. One reason, and I think the most popular reason that academics have gotten into talking about it, is sometimes academics get this idea that there's a better way of allocating risk than what we have right now. And wouldn't the world be a great place if we could get to that new end state? And so sometimes it's about that, about trying to make things better and really focusing on the merits of the end state. Sometimes reversibility is kind of an incremental way of getting there. We think it would be great if everyone had X risk allocation, but that's not the world now. Let's talk about building in some reversibility so we can test that out. We might generate information in the process as well. We might be able to learn about whether that's a good idea and convince the world to adopt that. So that's one reason, but there's also other reasons. One reason that we'll talk about a bit more later is that sometimes reversibility is favored because it generates liquidity in cases of selling particular claims and so on. Sometimes it's favored just for that reason. Sometimes also the reversibility is favored not because we sort of think there's some better arrangement in absolute terms, but because we think people vary. We think there's heterogeneity and that some people would like one risk arrangement, somebody wants something else. We want to make it possible for people to customize. And we might see this even as advancing some kind of autonomy interest, that we as a society don't force you to gamble. We make it possible for you to hedge risks. Or we don't force you to carry coverage. We make it possible for you to get out of it. Okay, there's lots of reasons that you probably already thought of why a lot of these reversal opportunities are not actually out there in the world. So sometimes they're missing. It might be because nobody thinks it's a good idea and the markets don't develop. But sometimes they're blocked. Sometimes there's legal prohibition saying you just can't do this. And so it's worth maybe thinking about a few issues, some of which come up just even with the risk reversal mechanisms we're all familiar with, things like insurance. So one issue, of course, with insurance generally is moral hazard. This is the idea that when you're insured against a risk, you will do less to keep that risk from coming about. And so we might think that is, we do think, in fact, that that's generally a problem with insurance, although it can often be controlled in a variety of ways by making the coverage a little bit incomplete or having co-payments or requiring particular precautions. So there can be some ways of dealing with it, but it may rule out certain kinds of insurance. So we don't really see the development of divorce insurance. We don't really see the development of, say, insurance against getting caught speeding on the highway, even though we all know there's a stochastic element to that and we might want to pool risk. It's just not available. We think these things are perhaps too much under people's own control. Now, when we talk about reverse insurance, it's kind of interesting because different issues arise. If we're talking about somebody selling off, say, their tort claims, we might think, well, this is kind of good from a moral hazard perspective. They've assigned to somebody else the right to recover if they get hurt, so they don't get anything when they get hurt, so they should really try to avoid it. It should seem to undo the moral hazard problem. But there might still be other problems. There might be, for example, concerns about them being motivated to participate in going after whatever claim against the injurer, given that they won't get anything out of it. There might be issues. Historically, there have been a lot of concerns about people holding an interest in somebody else getting injured or killed, right, that they might try to do them in or something like that. We might worry about that a little bit, presumably control it through criminal law. And so on. But there may also be another issue, which is that sometimes we have other background arrangements that can cause people's choices about insurance to have spillovers on other people. So to make that more clear, if we did have the ability for people to sell off their tort coverage, then we might worry about people getting hurt, becoming destitute, and then falling back on some other insurance pooling arrangement that we have, like a welfare system, right? And so we might think that that's going to offload costs. Now, there are a little bit of limits to this argument, though. It doesn't necessarily explain to us why people shouldn't be able to sell off amounts that would be in excess of whatever kind of baseline commitment we would make to giving people some kind of subsistence existence. But it's at least worth noting. Adverse selection is a different kind of problem, and especially interesting for reversibility issues because it arises out of having the opportunity to choose whether or not to carry insurance. The standard adverse selection story that arises just with regular insurance, we might worry about regular voluntary insurance, is that people who are especially likely to need the coverage may be especially likely to buy the coverage, and that only creates a problem if it's not possible for the insurer to tell good risks from bad risks and kind of price it appropriately. And so if that's not possible, then the fact that we have a lot of bad risks finding it to be a pretty good deal may end up causing the pricing to go to a level that it's not a good deal for the good risks, and they leave the pool, and there's concerns about unraveling and so on. There's potentially a little bit of a different issue that comes into play with reverse insurance, if you think about it. We might have people who want to, say, opt out of the tort system, be the ones that are especially unlikely to get hurt, and they might try to sort of convince the reverse insurer that they're bad risks, that, you know, you're getting a pretty valuable claim here because I'm, you know, I do dangerous things all the time and I'm probably going to get hurt soon, so that they can get a lot of money. But in fact, they would perhaps be better risks. So it plays out interestingly. There's also some issues about thinking about which default place we start from that might make a difference to some of these adverse selection arguments. And just to kind of maybe just illustrate that, we might wonder whether this act of opting in or opting out itself ends up having effects because of just the fact that any default is going to be somewhat sticky. If we think that maybe different risk groups are differentially influenced by default rules, sort of differentially inertial, so to speak, then we might get different results just for that reason. And we could maybe tell stories about why that might be the case. We might say, well, here, I'll just go ahead and, whoops, there we go. Let's say we have good risks and bad risks. We might say, well, maybe when we're in some kind of a situation where you have to opt in or opt out, maybe good risks are just, they pay more attention to the world. They're more likely to, you know, go out and buy insurance when they need it. Bad risks, even though it'd be a good deal for them, just are not likely to pay attention and won't do it. Or on the other hand, we might say, you know, maybe bad risks are really active people who are out there and aggressively seeking out opportunities, not willing to stay with the default. But if let's just for example, let's suppose that we think that there's some kind of insurance that would be a good deal for good risks and bad risks both, but it's only going to be a good deal for the good risks if there aren't too many bad risks in the pool because of the way the pricing will play out, and again, because of an inability for the insurers to tell the two apart. If we think that once this insurance pool opens, there's sort of a differential response, and the bad risks are sort of sluggishly moving in and don't really opt in fully, then it may be a sustainable pool, even though we have this potential theoretical problem with adverse selection. And there's been a lot of work done on adverse selection, by the way, sort of suggesting that maybe it's not as big a problem as people think, and a lot of exploration of what the reasons might be for why that is. This is sort of an additional reason. If we had the reverse situation like this, the good risks might instantly see, oh no, I'm in a pool with lots of bad risks. My pricing is much higher than it should be for my risk level. I'm getting out. And so we might end up with a very different kind of situation. Okay, there's a lot of other things about heterogeneity in risk arrangements that is also important, but I'll save that for Q&A. Another reason why we might not like reversibility is because of internalities, which is a term that's been used in the behavioral law and economics research as an analog to externalities. So externalities you're probably familiar with are external costs imposed on other parties that the decision maker doesn't take into account. It can sometimes lead to inefficient decisions. Internalities are costs on your later selves that you don't take into account. So we might really worry that people are going to make decisions about risk bearing that will be bad for their later selves. And so, for example, in the example of selling off your tort claims, we might think that people are, one reason might be that they're myopic. They care more about today's self than they want money now. And they might also be overly optimistic. They think, I won't get hurt. Turns out that they will. Their later self will be unhappy. So we might, this would be sort of a self-paternalism kind of idea, saying that we want to save people from themselves, and that even they might want to be saved from themselves in some cases. Here it's important to note, though, that even though kind of for convenience we've been talking about these reversals, like selling off tort claims, as involving giving somebody else a claim and getting like a big wad of money right now, it wouldn't necessarily have to take that form. So here we can actually separate out the timing of payments from what's actually happening with risk. What's important about changing the risk arrangement is that you're changing a gamble, an uncertain variable outcome, for a some certain. But it doesn't demand that you get that like right now. You could get that in installments. You could get it later after a delay. And it would still accomplish the risk shift. Now, it wouldn't accomplish these other liquidity purposes that people sometimes might have in mind as a reason why they want to do this. Arguably, we should separate out the two things and have capital markets, lending markets, for dealing with people's liquidity issues, and then allow people to break out risk. If we're worried about people kind of wanting to grab the big wad of cash now, we could still offer them the chance to change around their risk arrangements simply by changing when the timing of payout and so on. Other things that we can do might involve not ruling out entire reversals, but just making them stickier, making people have to reflect on them or take their time making the decision or go through some hoops in order to do it. And we can also play with the defaults, as has been noted in the behavioral law and economics literature, to try to encourage people in the right direction. Okay, so one issue to think about, too, in internalities, and this also relates to externalities, is that not all of these shifts are of the same nature. If you think about all the whole range of different reversal opportunities. So sometimes when you pay to improve your risk position, what you're doing is you're buying insurance, which is going to give you a payout that will fill in for some loss that might happen in your life. And so the idea is that you're getting some kind of a backfill. Other times when you're paying out, you're paying out for something that's going to give you what I call here gravy, some kind of a return above your current baseline. And sometimes there's something else that's going on that's sort of a hybrid. One example that people mention sometimes in this connection is products liability coverage. Richard Craswell, for example, has noted that when you buy a product, it's common to note that it comes bundled with some insurance, but it also comes bundled, arguably, with something like a lottery ticket. If you might end up recovering and getting, say, punitive damages that do more than backfill for what happened to you and actually give you something above that. So in thinking about reversals, we might care about what it is that you're undoing. So we might feel differently about people's choices to expose themselves to a ditch, so to speak, by selling off their ability to get backfill than we would feel about losing gravy, or even about hybrids. Hybrids, we might think about how to break out those above and below baseline components. Now, of course, another issue that comes into play here is framing effects. Where these baselines are is somewhat malleable. And also, we might think that markets in reversibility sometimes don't come about because people are effectively, because of the framing effects themselves, because something seems new and unfamiliar, and switching to something may be very cognitively different than if you already have it and you're sort of deciding whether to move away from it. There also may just be some innovation costs. So one question is whether we don't see some things that would be actually valuable just because it is too costly. It's sort of a public good to develop a new model, and this is another issue that's been discussed in the literature. So this is the last slide. I guess the goal of the talk is to maybe get you to think more about reversibility, think more consciously about the risk arrangements that we have and whether they should be more reversible. Some reasons to do that is it can help us identify gaps. We can see places where there might be room to shift. Not all of those will it make sense for us to fill. There might be good reasons why there's gaps, but it can help us to identify them. It's also, I think, helpful to keep arguments separate. Whether when we're objecting or criticizing some potential way of rearranging risk, is it that we think it's inherently a bad way of arranging risk, Or is it that we're worried about the heterogeneity, about people having different arrangements? Are we worried about the reversal process itself? Are we worried about time preferences, or that we maybe could address in different ways? Or is it really a concern with risk preferences? And then finally, just to get to the kind of two-part societal decision, I think it's important to focus attention on the implications of default settings, because those might matter a lot, even if from two different defaults with the chance to reverse, we could potentially get to the same place. It may matter where we start. And also questions of optimal stickiness, sort of, you know, how hard should it be to move? To what extent do we want to induce people to reflect on things? Or in contrast, how often do we want to perhaps make it easier for people to make shifts from a particular position? Okay, so I'll stop there and questions. Yes.
Can I just ask a little bit about, when we're talking about good risks and bad risks,
yeah.
To a certain extent, isn't that just our effectiveness at pricing?
Absolutely. That's exactly it. And so the whole adverse selection issue disappears if it's possible to have perfect pricing. Now, there's an interesting thing here, though, because sometimes it's that the insurer really can't tell the good risk from the bad risk. There also sometimes are situations where there might be legal prohibitions on using certain kinds of information in order to separate out the good risk from bad risk. So some of you may have heard about recent legislation about using genetic test results. So there we have maybe the technology exists to tell risks apart, but for other social reasons, we feel like that it's more appropriate distributionally. We think that people behind the veil would choose to have this not be part of the picture of their pricing. But it effectively does, I mean, one way to put it is that it does effectively bundle in sort of some redistributive element. And many people worry that it might cause adverse selection kinds of problems because you're suppressing some price information that might be valuable. And if it results in pricing that's too high for the people who are actually good risks, then they may end up going out of the market. Now, some of these adverse selection problems are also they sort of go away under certain kinds of group insurance arrangements and so on. Like if you're sort of part of a group plan as part of your employment and so on, people may not sort of flee from the pool. But all the same, there is sort of this effect. And so there are some very interesting implications about opt-in versus opt-out when we think about issues where society is consciously choosing to do something with the pricing and to suppress certain kinds of information. So I'll just go through a quick example to kind of, because I happen to have a slide here. So if we think about risk pooling that kind of builds in redistribution, let's say we have a population of 100 people and 90 of them are what we'd call good risks. They have expected costs of $100 for losses. But we have 10 that have really, really high, this is sort of an extreme example, but you know, $10,000 losses. And let's say society wants the 90 to subsidize the 10. I don't mean to suggest that's wrong at all. I mean, it's quite plausible that behind the veil, people would want this information to not matter if we think about this as something like genetic information about risk, a risk. And so it forbids the use of risk information in pricing. The adverse selection concern here is the premiums are you know, 1,090. The low-risk people who have expected costs of 100, maybe they're not that risk-averse. They're not going to buy it, and they might not buy the insurance. That's the concern. Now, of course, we can force them into the pool. We can have pools that make it harder for them to leave. We can suppress information gathering. We can say, you can't find out your type, so you don't know whether it's too high for you or not. We could think about doing a different way, which is kind of interesting. If we had an opt-out system where we started with everybody in the pool and we said, okay, here's how much it costs in taxes to support this pool. It's 1090. And we just sort of said you can opt out of the risk pool and get back your actuarially fair amount for your own risk. What that would effectively do is it would say everybody has to contribute to this redistributive scheme, but you don't really have to be part of the risk pool. And then if we let people opt out, we can say, you know, okay, you want to leave, you think you're low risk, you want to leave. Let's now actually look at that information about your risk level, and here's how much you would get, like $100, right? And so we might say it avoids adverse selection because it allows for accurate pricing. Now, of course, we might worry that the high-risk people, too, would say, I want out, and I get like a really big check when I leave because my expected costs are high. And here we might say that kind of defeats the purpose of what we were trying to do with our system, which was to provide insurance in kind to those folks. So I think it's very helpful in these cases to try to think about what our goals are and whether sometimes we do mean to provide to people insurance that's in kind rather than just sort of give them the cash equivalent. And so maybe we only mean to redistribute by offering certain risk coverages and not by just sort of giving the expected value equivalent of that. Questions? Yes.
So I guess from a sort of philosophical point of view, shouldn't we worry a lot about taking something like the tort system, which is ostensibly about compensating people for their losses, and divorcing it from that entirely as a sort of setup? You could have people always sell the potential tort claim, and then you end up having one big faceless company suing another faceless company about some person who's not even around. Isn't it worrying that we're sort of allowing our justice system to become another sort of swap machine?
Well, you know, okay, so first of all, I mean, I'm not necessarily, you know, sort of advocating that we should do sort of strong forms of this or anything, but you're right to sort of raise how the way that we conceive of the tort system really does play in here. Now, if we take an economic view, which we wouldn't have to at all, but we focus on sort of incentives for insurers, we might say, well, their incentives are still there if there's somebody who can still recover. And so we might think that they are going to do the right thing or the efficient thing or whatever. But you're right. If we view the tort system as providing compensation for people that are hurt, I mean, I guess there's sort of a question of what we mean by compensation. We might say, you know, we are compensating people. We're compensating people for the risks that they run, right? The companies are creating risk in the world. And maybe we see the tort system as dealing with that risk. And so we could say when you sell your tort claim, you're being compensated for the risks that you run, and you're simply choosing to handle your own coverage of whatever injuries you may have. Now, if we really view, though, the tort system as in sort of an ex-ante way that after people are hurt, it needs to make them whole, then that's a different story. And also, I suppose, if we think of it in a corrective justice sense of undoing a wrong between these two parties, which I think is part of your question, then we might be worried about the fact that we end up having trials that are sort of not between those two parties and that justice is being done between two parties that are not the exact two parties that were party to the injury that we might want to be rectifying. So I agree that it really matters in thinking about this and that might be a cost of allowing changes from this system to a different system. There might also obviously be some practical issues like I mentioned before. If the person doesn't really have any stake in whether or not there's a recovery from the person that they sold their claim to, you know, will they show up for trial? Will they wear the neck brace? Will they do whatever? And so we might, have to think about ways to control those kinds of risks to get people to participate. We might find juries not wanting to give awards as much, right? If they knew that who it's going to, if they were aware of it, if that information could be known, that it's going to big company X and not to the person here that we're seeing before us who got so badly hurt by this company, it might really change things. Again, there's kind of a, you know, value judgments about whether that should matter, but you know we could certainly imagine it mattering a lot. Yes.
I was wondering how this risk allocation plays into general notions we may have about what things be commoditized. So there are certain activities we don't allow to be commoditized, like prostitution, but there might also be certain risks. So some people feel very strongly morally against Social Security or life insurance. But if you push that even further, I mean, people may feel very strongly that there shouldn't be, like, rape insurance, that, you know, everybody could buy and they get a payout if they get raped. And has there been any literature, what are your thoughts about commoditizing certain risks that we should not commoditize for moral reasons, separate and apart from the economic reasons?
Right. So, I mean, a lot of these, there does end up being a lot of convergence, but I think, between the kinds of things that we might have moral objections to people insuring against and things that would create what sort of goes by the term of art, moral hazard, which isn't really about morality, but is about sort of, you know, this risk that people will influence their own claims. I suppose there's it may relate back a little bit to the other question earlier about whether we might think that some kinds of wrongs need to be corrected in a particular way, and that we think insurance is sort of an inappropriate way of addressing them. There may also just be instances where we think that whatever it is that somebody's trying to insure against. So for example, if we were to offer insurance, if it was possible for people who are participating in armed robberies to insure against the chance that, like, a stray bullet will hit somebody and kill them, we might think that's something, even though there's a stochastic element to that, and maybe all the armed robbers would like to participate in a risk pool for that. It may just be chance whether somebody gets killed or not. But we may think that leaving people fully exposed to those risks is very important, and that having insurance in those kinds of settings would be deeply wrong. So I'm not sure if that fully gets to it. There's also this other issue, which is that sometimes harms that people suffer cannot really be compensated by money. So, and this is actually sort of an interesting question as to how this plays out. If part of what people get paid for in jury verdicts, for example, is pain and suffering, or let's say the loss of a minor child. So people sort of said these are things that don't actually increase your need for money, typically. Losing a child is extremely costly emotionally, but not really financially. And so there's this question of whether money ends up appropriately compensating, and so there might be sort of a question there about whether even the judgments that exist under the existing tort system inappropriately commoditize things. There might be this question of, what's the alternative? If there's been this kind of injury, money may be the only currency that's available. But there still may be these questions about certain kinds of losses that aren't really monetary losses, and that money doesn't make better in some sense. Yes.
Can there be some sort of mandatory benefit to this kind of system that might incentivize people to evaluate their own risk in a way that they don't today? We hear all about how the general public's perception of their own risk is fairly inaccurate in a system like this, where they're evaluating their own risk in a way that might cause them more accurate. Is that any?
I mean. So that would be sort of an optimistic story about this, is that if we got people to really think about maybe the opportunity cost of certain kinds of societal arrangements, and sort of think like, maybe if I were to sell this, I could get something, and that would cause them to sort of think, is it worth it, and how much could I get, and how much risk am I at, and so on. Yeah, I think there could be that. I mean, there's, I guess, concerns the other way, that people might systematically be so bad at figuring out their risk that they would be taken advantage of by reverse insurers who would be, like, really good at it. But you might say if there's competition among reverse insurers, then people might start to get some kind of educational benefit from this, sort of learning what it is that their risks are worth and so on, and learning that they can get a much bigger payment if they're a motorcycle rider, for example, rather than if they're not, might sort of alert them to the fact that, hey, actually this is pretty dangerous, or something like that. So I think there could be those benefits. It might be that this overlaps a little bit with some of the arguments for things like prediction markets. If we start to have a lot of competition and we have a lot of aggregation of different information about risks, then it may end up making it better able for people to accurately assess things. And so I think that's at least potentially there. We might worry a little bit, especially in sort of the early stages, and we might actually want some kind of either watchdog or governmental information group or something like that to try to help people in making sure that they are making judgments that line up to actuarial risks. Yes.
I think when we look at this, we might think that getting paid up front for being willing to incur, something later seems sort of wrong to us. Seems a little bit unsettling that people might be taking advantage of in that way. But if, as you said, later on, the money isn't really going to make them whole, do you think that you could spin it in such a way as to say that if they were to receive this money up front, they could actually make a lot more use of it than they would be after, say, their child dies by, you know, providing them good education or being able to enjoy the money when they still sort of had everything that they wanted rather than later? I know that sounds a little odd, but maybe it could be sort of a positive spin on receiving the money first rather than.
Right. I think that's a great point. And actually, people who've written in this area have really kind of focused on that point. So one way to think about it is that we might ask, so one of the advantages of thinking about reversibility is we can always kind of try to flip and say, what if we were starting from a different default? And so we might say, if you were a parent and you were choosing in a world that didn't have tort coverage, of any kind, you're choosing what kinds of insurance to purchase, would you choose to purchase a lot of life insurance for your child? Would you choose to purchase insurance against pain and suffering? Would you choose to purchase insurance against these things that we might think after the fact the money's not really going to help you? Or would you rather keep the money and not spend it? When you think about it that way, you know, I mean, most people don't take out huge life insurance policies on their children. It's not because they don't love their children. It's because they recognize that if they were to lose a child, that it wouldn't be a financially impacting event. To a very great, you know, aside from, you know, maybe minor burial costs or something. I mean, it wouldn't be a major financial impact, but it, you know, and so they'd rather have the money in the state of the world where there's not yet been that injury or that loss. And so I think that's exactly right. And so I suppose that's one lesson of this, is to try to always think about whether people would buy particular insurance packages anew if they were starting from a baseline where they didn't already have it. Selling it off sounds weird. Like, reverse insurance sounds very exotic and strange, and why would anybody want to give up something that they have? But we might wonder whether we're kind of suffering from some kind of a cognitive status quo bias or an endowment effect kind of idea that, you know, we have this, we don't want to give it up. But if you didn't have it to start with, would you go out? Would you go out and seek it out and buy it? Is that the question? I don't know if any research has been done on that. One thing that may be relevant in thinking about this is sort of what other societal arrangements we have. Even to the extent of having situations where there's less intergenerational transfers as a result of having things like Social Security for old age and those kinds of things, those can matter about these other kinds of decisions. But that's a great question. Yeah.
What happens in like a tort claim when someone has incurred great medical costs and suppose they got their $30, $100 2 years ago or something like that, but now they're facing exorbitant bills? Mm-hmm.
Okay, so first of all, it's not really my system, but really this is meant to be analytic and kind of like, you know, how would we think about this? What would happen then? This is like the question of would there be externalities as a result? So people might make this choice, or internalities. So we might worry both about the person because we think it's bad that they're now in the state of the world where they're suffering. We might also think that it's costly for other people if it's not really the case that they've fully shed their risk. If other social institutions are going to come in, or even family or other people are going to have to pitch in, then it may seem as if they sold something that wasn't really theirs to sell, in a sense, because their protection was also protection for other people, either other people in the social insurance scheme that they might share, or even just direct family members. And so I think that might be a very real cost. And I think a lot of our concerns become greater when we start talking about people selling off things that are going to potentially expose them to things that will bring them below their kind of baseline level, and certainly kinds of medical expenses where an untreated condition is going to cause some kind of serious injury or death would qualify as being that kind of situation. And so I think rightly we worry more there, both because of people just making bad decisions and we feel bad for that, but also because we think that there may be costs elsewhere. Yes?
As
the literature said anything about the interaction of various safety nets? Like, in our particular society,
right.
There would be a torts claim for motorcycle accident or whatever, but if you don't have any money, you go to the emergency room system, you mm-hmm. go those huge X amount. I wonder if any of the literature addresses that in some ways, aside from, well, I guess get rid of all sorts of safety nets, make this work.
Okay, yeah, so certainly people have talked about this a lot. So this is something that's actually often cited for all kinds of regulations that are out there, not just social insurance arrangements, but also just regulations, like should people have to wear safety belts or motorcycle helmets, or should they be kept from eating trans fats or whatever else. This idea that, well, you know, it's okay for you to do it. You say you're making your own choice, but then, you know, you're going to come crying to me whenever you have this, you know, the society's going to have to pay in the long run because it'll lead to more expensive costs for everybody else that will be covered. And so that is a point that's often raised. You're absolutely right that often a response to it is to say, well, that's just because we have this social insurance net that does that, and if we didn't have that, then it wouldn't be an issue. But there certainly may be certain normative commitments, I think quite rightly, that our society is just not going to give up. It's not and for perhaps very self-interested reasons, we could even support it even aside from altruism to say it's not in anybody's interest to live in a society where people are, you know, starving in the streets or have sort of, you know, untreated wounds. You know, it's just not a good thing generally. And so we are going to have certain commitments, and that means that people can't really offload all that risk. I mean, they can't really offload all that coverage and take on all that risk, because we're essentially saying we're not going to allow you to. We as a society are going to provide some of these things in kind. So I think the interaction of the safety nets is extremely important in thinking about how far reversibility can go. But the fact that it might not be possible to fully reverse things doesn't mean that we might not have partial reversals that would undo part of what we currently have under given arrangements. And also, I'm very interested, you know, we've talked kind of a lot about the reverse insurance side of things, but I do think it's also very interesting to think about places where we might people might actually want more coverage than what we have, and we kind of think it's normal now that people are exposed to things. So we think it's sort of normal that homeowners should, for example, bear all the risk of what happens in the local housing market. Now we're sort of finding out that's kind of disastrous, right? And so, you know, there may be instances where we're missing opportunities to actually let people get more insurance that would have similar impacts on whatever else happens with social safety nets out in the world. So, you know, it might not be necessary to have different kinds of responses societally when all kinds of housing markets simultaneously drop if we had different arrangements up front. Now, I'm not suggesting that a different risk arrangement would have necessarily forestalled the entire subprime crisis by any means, but there may be instances in which our current arrangement just seems right to us because it's familiar. And when we really think about it, you know, why is it that a homeowner who can't at all control what's happening out in their local housing market is bearing the upside and the downside of those fluctuations in a very undiversified investment? Yes. Right.
I really don't see the difference between deciding not to be insured and getting paid and having this reverse risk.
That's exactly right. Yep. Yeah. So, very important generally to think about how we can get to the same place from either of two beginning points. So we could start with everybody being insured and have an opting out kind of system, or we could have just sort of, as is generally the case for sort of working-aged adults in the U.S., you know, sort of an opt-in where, you know, you can choose to not buy coverage. And so, you know, I guess there's sort of political questions about whether there is something that's to be gained by having it be opt-in versus opt-out. But the question about the sort of end state of being not covered, you know, if we think that that's problematic, then we should think that that's problematic regardless of whether you get there by never buying insurance or whether you get there by already having insurance and selling it off. So, you know, I suppose in part, to the extent that we think that some of the ideas about selling off coverage are a bad idea, it might also make us wonder about having voluntary systems in other parts of the system that don't force people to purchase insurance and don't make them be part of a mandatory pool. Yes?
This discussion had to be going back to my pricing
question. Yeah.
And the question is, is there research that's been done on determining how to price the impacts of these safety net issues? So, we didn't have adequate pricing and the risk of insurance for
sure.
The fact that the government was probably going to bail out and something like that or hold the risk. So if the risk is overvalued, or we're paying too much for a risk that's not really as dramatic as it because of the safety net, is there any resources that's been done on how to cut out that safety net from the price that we were looking for?
So if I understand what you're asking, it's sort of a so implicitly, certain kinds of risks, if they are societally covered, are not going to be borne by the actors that are sort of nominally bearing them, right? So
right.
So the question is,
you sell the full value of the market, but really you know that there's going to be some externality that society's going to bear because we're not going to let you live on the street with
right. Right. So I guess the question is whether that gets priced in. In theory, we should imagine that default risk gets priced in to say mortgages. To the extent that it's going to be possible for someone to default and there won't be enough other assets to go after and so on, then that in a sense suggests that there's part of the risk that is that's not being borne. So mortgages are really supposed to be about liquidity and not about shifting risk, but they're both. I mean, they're kind of both to the extent that the lender isn't going to be able to recover in all instances in all states of the world. And so that should be priced, in theory, that should be priced in. So it should cause worse risk to have more expensive loans. But, yeah.
I'm asking more of a question about whether or not people have looked into ways of pricing probability that the society at large is not willing to let that threshold be crossed. So
right.
The banking system, we're not willing to let an AIG fail. And so investigate how to price risks for assets that AIG is selling based on the fact that as an intermediary, that those transactions, if they fail, those transactions won't work.
Yeah.
So we're not willing to let that happen. So,
right. Right. So I don't know specifically on that, and there probably are people who have tried to look at this. One question is how expected the rescue is. So sometimes if it's extremely unprecedented, people can't expect it, then we don't know how much it gets built in. One area I think where there's been interest in looking at this that's sort of different is people who build in floodplains, for example. What will happen? Will there be some kind of disaster response by the government? And to what extent does anticipation of that change the way that people make decisions? And so I think that should be very much a part of how we think about, both governmental responses and sort of what people do sort of ex ante and what kinds of choices we encourage or discourage. Yes?
Can you solve the problem of, for instance, like the simple example of someone who, sells off their ability to collect on say some sort of injury, and they get hit by a bus, and they collect $100 and they have $100,000 in medical bills, so they fall back on Medicare or some other social welfare thing. Can you solve that by just taxing the reverse insurance to the extent that they're going to be a risk to an extra burden on the social welfare system, or is there some problem with that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a question of whether that ends up being the equivalent of just saying you can't sell your full claim. So one thing you could say is you can sell your tort claims except for the portion that would keep you at a level that is just a hair above where you would qualify for these social programs. So that would be one way, I think, of getting at the result. And so I think actuarially, maybe does that sort of work out the same way if we said, okay, you can sell your whole tort claim, but you need to pay us. You need to then pay us this installment that's equivalent to the amount of that represents the risk that you're creating to this other system. I think it works out to be the same, but there might be some advantages, though. Certainly, cognitively or administratively, there might be reasons for doing it one way or another, depending. But yeah, I think that's a huge concern with any of these kinds of things, is making sure that we aren't just moving costs around to some other place and somehow redistributing to people in instances where we didn't mean to, you know. That might be it. This is a good place to stop. So thank you again.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.